This is Forrest Elise interviewing Ellen Wagner for the Creative Push Project on September 4th? Okay. I have a weird thing with dates. 4th at 10:15. All right. So I'm going to let you take the floor. Oh, by the way, I know you have two births. You can start with the first one and then go into the second, or we can do the second as like a second recording block. So
let's start with the first.
Okay. That sounds great. If we could try to keep them separate.
Let's keep them separate.
Comparing, that would
let's start with the first, because I think that's more the details that relate to the art that are
okay.
The art that I made
sure.
Based on the birth.
Sure. But we definitely want to get the second.
But then I'll get to the second
okay.
One.
So if you could just take us back to that time, you know, go back as far as the conception, if you can.
I was in art school. I was 22. Living in Washington, D.C., all alone, no family around, lots of creative, interesting friends. I wasn't particularly focused on school or anything, even though I was in college. I'd been in college by that time for 5 years, and this was my third university. I was looking to move as far away from my home in Iowa and anything I knew as possible. So Washington, D.C. was about as far away as I could get. So my son was born in 1988, but he was conceived on a trip I took on the back of a Harley riding through the month of December from Washington, D.C. to San Diego, and then down the Baja coast. I'd bought the Harley from my boyfriend at the time. And I thought this was just like the most amazing madcap adventure possible. And I distinctly remember coming through Phoenix at the time on December 23rd, 1986. I remember the weather and everything about it. And I had intended to go back to college, of course, in January. Christopher was conceived on a raucous night in Mexico on the Baja coast amongst a lot of tequila shots. And I knew it the moment that it happened. I absolutely knew it. I just knew it. And then I remember I had to go back to school 10 days later. And I had said goodbye to the father, the presumed eventual father of this child, in front of the Whiskey-A-Go-Go on Sunset Boulevard on January 14th, 1988. Said goodbye. Knew pretty much I would never, ever see him again. And I did not see him again until Christopher was 2 for 6 hours once, and then I didn't see him again until Christopher graduated from high school. So that was a long time, no conversation with the father at all. So I had no support and no family and no people around, and everybody told me I should give up this child while I was in college and that I should not follow through this pregnancy. And I explored the options, but not too far. Just went ahead and decided, no, I was going to figure this out somehow and I was going to keep this child. You know, so it was just Christopher and I. My pregnancy, I remember being exciting, even though it was I was the only one participating in it, and there was nothing like baby showers with, you know, crepe paper. It was a lot like the conception was. It was based with strange friends around me who had a lot of drug and alcohol problems, and I was trying to keep it together and try to figure out how I'm going to create a life for this child in the future, and what was I going to do in Washington, D.C. with this child as an art school graduate.
So how are you handling being 23 and, I'm sure, partaking in tequila and your youth?
Well,
like,
I quit immediately about when I really realized how pregnant I was. 2 months in, I quit smoking marijuana immediately. I quit doing any kind of drug that I was used to doing, including ecstasy, cocaine, acid, anything. I mean, I was a girl who liked a drug salad. I loved it. And so I quit doing that, and I became an artist model to support myself. And that was an interesting transition for me as a woman, to go from being a very young, sexual young woman who felt really uncomfortable with her sexuality, but yet expressed myself probably more sexually than most women did. And yet I was really uncomfortable about it. And I found that when I was pregnant, both the transition that happened, I found interesting that I liked myself physically more, because when I was an artist model and I was taking my clothes off now, it didn't seem sexual. Now, the thing I think that it probably you have to understand is that before I was an artist model, and before I had Christopher, I'd also worked in a strip club, not as a dancer though, because I so don't look like a dancer. However, I had this desperate need when I was in college to be objectified as a woman, which sounds like a totally weird thing in the age of feminism, but I needed to know where I was or a placement as a woman or what men thought about me, because growing up I'd had really bad experiences with boyfriends, with brothers, with my father. And so I wanted to be seen, believe it or not, when I was like about 21, 22 years old, before I was pregnant, I really wanted to be seen like a really sexy girl. I just wanted to know what that was like for a little while. So having had that experience as a cocktail waitress, it was a lot of fun. Made a lot of money, bought a Harley.
So were your family and boyfriends, did they say negative things about your...
My family had no idea what was going on with me. No, I lived far away from everyone.
When you felt, when you said you had a hard time with them growing up...
Oh.
Did they give you body image issues?
Oh, yes, terribly. Or? My nickname as a child was Ellen Capel in the Watermelon. That was the nice nickname. The nickname I grew up with that caused me all the trouble in my life until about years of therapy and working through it just this past summer was Double Ugly. Double Ugly. I loathed the nickname. I loathed it. And I was known as Double Ugly and Ellen Capel and the Watermelon and Smelling Ellen so much that by the time I'd run away from home, and I mean run away from home and never speak to your family again, I needed to somehow psychologically unravel these nicknames and these impressions I had of myself. And so I put myself in these really bizarre situations, like working in a really high-end strip club on M Street in Washington, D.C., and watching the other girls. One was a college friend who was a feminist artist who did work while she was a stripper. It was amazing, basing her work on audience reaction. I felt that I needed to learn something about myself. So for about 5 months, I cocktailed 5 nights a week, dressed as a Playboy bunny, just to work through this body image thing I had. And it worked. I worked through something for sure. But I think even more so was gaining all this weight while I was pregnant and really getting comfortable with myself. I wouldn't get up on a stage and take my clothes off for money, but I would get up on a stage and take off my clothes to have people make art. So I think there's a difference there, that it's a hard line to see the difference between these two things. But for me, moving into motherhood and accepting myself as sort of, diva sitting on a lotus flower for people to paint and seeing me as an object of beauty and fertility was a whole lot different than the experience I had when I watched colleagues or peers, other women, making hundreds of dollars, taking their clothes off in front of me at night. These were two different things for me. So, but they were both, I think, in some ways to help me get over a lot of body image, which, you know, became the narrative, the narrative arc that ran through all of my life as a young woman. Was that narrative. And it's taken me till, I'm 50 now, it's taken me literally till probably just this summer to be able to totally unravel it and not let it to let those names, those thoughts of my sexuality and who I was, you know, and being a girl that was raised in a strict Catholic background in a small country town in Iowa, and I was pregnant when I was in college, unmarried, I didn't tell my family I even had a baby. I didn't tell my family that Christopher was born until the day Christopher was born. The day Christopher was born, my mother, I know this because she told me the story later, had to tell my family, who was having dinner together that night, "So, Ellen had a baby today." And my family just were like, "Well, how can that be? How can she have a baby?" And I did. That's how things, I think, worked with me. I found myself to be an incredible outsider in my family, so everything I did seemed to happen really in my own world.
Yeah.
So.
Wow. Okay, so take us back to the pregnancy.
Let me tell you a little bit about the pregnancy. People told me I couldn't have this child, and I explored abortion options. I went far. I went to the point of scheduling having an abortion in Washington, D.C., because the father wasn't involved, and I was just so beyond what I could do, and I felt that this was the only thing I could do. So I scheduled this, and I go to the appointment, and the doctor doesn't show up. And I'm like, oh my God, this is rough. So the next thing that happens, I remember, was maybe I'm at that point 14 weeks pregnant, and you're probably past, you know, making that choice. And so I remember the women's health clinic made another appointment for me in New York City, and I was supposed to drive to New York City. I couldn't imagine doing this, but at that time I could. It's like I was going to drive to New York City by myself, get on a train and check in to a hotel room, ostensibly entirely by myself, and have an abortion. I thought I could do this, and I planned to do it. I made the appointment. I was going to do it all alone. And once again, something happens where they call me and say, not going to happen, doctor doesn't come. I mean, this freak experience. I could never figure out how this came to be that now I'm past. I'm so far past the time of even considering this that I recognize I'm having a baby. This conception is a surprise. This even idea that I'm going to have a baby is a surprise. I'm sleeping on a couch at a friend's house with my dog. I have no job anymore. I have no money, and I can't call my family and tell them what has happened to me because there's no love and there's no support there. So I slept on a couch. I literally slept on a couch till I was too fat to sleep on the couch on the corner of 16th Street and Columbia Road. Just blocks from the White House, just straight up the street from the White House. It was an amazingly complicated time, but, you know, friends were kind of around. And then a friend volunteered to go through birthing classes with me. We did something called the Bradley Method, which was very, not so much on breathing techniques. It was based on intuitive connectedness, which I really liked, and what exactly was going to happen that day when you went to the hospital. And so I felt psychologically probably more prepared than other people seem to have told me they were when they went in to have a baby. I felt pretty ready about what was going to happen that day because I'd written a birth plan. I had planned to take my best friend from college, a woman, with me to hold my hand. A friend had come along who said I could live in his apartment with him for a couple, you know, a former boyfriend who said, you can come and live with me after the baby was born, you know, and we'll see what happens. So I felt fine going into the actual delivery. I think one of the other reasons I felt pretty good was I was having this artist modeling experience, and I was really comfortable with myself physically. And I was working with midwives, which was a little different than going to a hospital. So every time I would go to a midwife's appointment at Georgetown University, there were often different people in the room. So there would be students there, and there would be maybe a different midwife than I'd had the last time. So it was sort of like, Ellen's having a baby, and it's a community event. And so when the actual day came in the hospital, I do remember lots of people came in to watch. It was more like a learning experience and an art happening kind of thing, or at least I thought when I was going in, it's going to be a lot of people because people were excited about coming to see, and I had invited a lot of people along the way that were in the midwifery department to come and watch the birth because I wasn't afraid yet. And I had no plan to have there were no video cameras. We did take some photos, but it was a living, be there event. So people were kind of invited to come, and people showed up, which was nice. There were a number of women in the room. The best thing I remember happening, and the thing that I always like telling people about, was that this woman came in the room that I had never met before, and that she was not a midwife I had been introduced to previously, but she came into the room, I remember, and I didn't have a long labor. It had started the night before, and I didn't tell the people in my house that it started on Sunday night. But I knew it was through the night. I knew I was laboring alone, which for me always seemed like the most natural thing to do is just, you're in your own headspace. But this woman came in, and she was like this angel. And I remember her sitting down behind me and saying to me, you're not in pain. You're just connected to this bigger part of the universe. And these sensations you're feeling are all a part of this birth process. And there's nothing here that's going to hurt you, and you're going to be fine, and we're going to breathe through this. And she just held me with this huge sense of love. And I remember, even though my son's father was not there and he didn't know the baby was being born that day, I could feel him in the room. I felt my grandma in the room, who had passed away about 6 months earlier. I felt this huge sense of love in the room. Not from my immediate family or people that other people would think you would possibly invite in. That's not who was there for me. It was other people. It was people who just came to be there for the experience. And so for me, the whole birthing part went very quickly. There was no pain, and I remember having a primal scream that was extremely exciting. It just felt like the Big Bang Theory was in me, and I loved it. I loved the birthing part. That part, I remember thinking, was great. It was so different than what other people told me afterwards and people wanted to share with me before. It was exciting. It was a roller coaster. I remember things like being offered an epidural, and I said, oh no, this will be the one thing I will do totally drug-free. I will remember every sensation and every moment. I remember not being able to handle smells in the room because I was too sensitive to everything. Everything was a sensation. Smells made me want to vomit, and that was cleansing. I thought I wanted to have a lot of music in the room. I didn't. I just wanted the sound of people in the room. I remember, and this is the first time I remembered this again, there was a target on the wall they wanted me to focus on, and I said, remove the target. I can't have these sort of visuals in the room. I needed it to be just a clear, clear headspace, because I felt this need to go so deep in my head and into my psyche. I didn't want it to be as much of a physical experience. I wanted this deeply spiritual connectedness, because I thought, this is it. It's, you know, life is a one-time thing, and this is probably the only time I'm going to have a child. This is the only kind of child I'm going to have with this man. And I wanted it to be perfection. I wanted it to be something I would never forget, that was perfect and glorious and filled with details that I would want to share again, that hopefully when in April, someone else, if I kept telling this story over and over, someone else would hear this and say, I'm going to have a birth like that. I'm going to have this sort of experience where angels are in the room singing, and you feel like this is what I was meant to do. And I've told people so many times, oh, you know, I'm an utter, I'm a fuck up in so many parts of my life, but the one thing I'm very good at is birthing children. I could be a midwife. I could probably pull over and deliver a child. So by the time I was pregnant, well, let's stop and say I did not talk to the father of Christopher. My son's name is Christopher Robin. I didn't talk to Christopher's father. I saw him briefly once in California for one night, for a few hours, and that was it. No conversation, hardly even remember what was said. And then I saw him again 18 years later when Christopher graduated from high school and he finally wanted to reconnect with his father. And by then I was married. I'd been married for many years. And I was way over the pain of being left. You know, I was over it. And I felt like I was psychologically and purposefully and life, everything was going just great in my life. So I was ready for this new thing to happen and to reintroduce Christopher to his father for the first time. So after an exhaustive search, lots of phone callings, lots of calling to the universe, I gave his father a deadline, like in my mind. It was very specific. It was 12 o'clock, March 15th, during the last commercial set of The Young and the Restless, which I used to draw to every day without fail for 20-some years. Those were studio hours for me. I had told a friend the night before, if he doesn't call by tomorrow, I quit thinking about him. It's been 18 years. You know, a girl's got to move on, even in her heart. I'd been holding this man in my heart even though I was married. He still had part of my heart. And there was a lot of unfinished, you know, but forgiveness. But I had reached out 2 months before looking for him, just out of curiosity. And since I hadn't had a call back, I decided that morning at noon, that was when we would never think about this anymore and I would have to call it quits. And I'll tell you, at 11:57, I swear it's the truth, 11:57, the phone rings. I turn it over and I see the caller ID. I take a huge breath, like your first gasp of air, you know, out of water. And I pick up the phone and I said, is it really you? And he said, yes, it's really me. I said, I can't believe you made it in 3 minutes. And he's like, I'm on time, aren't I? I said, no way. You know, and it felt like I had, the conversation I remember flowed like we had just spoken maybe 2 hours ago. Because I said, I'd waited 18 years. I've waited 18 years. I gave you till noon. You made it. You made it at 11:56. 11:58, you made it? He said, well, I'm under the wire. So I reconnect with my son's father then on June 28th. 2007, and 3 months later I was pregnant. I saw him two or three times in between. I saw him once in July, I saw him once in August, and by September I was pregnant.
With his baby?
Yes. And I married at the time in a rather high-profile marriage here in, you know, in Arizona. People knew me very well, very well. And I was not pregnant with my husband's child. I'm pregnant with my son's father, and I'm going to have children. This is the amazing part I say to people. I have children by the same father. By the same father. Who does that these days? Sure, there was an 18-year hiatus with no conversation, but, you know, a couple of tequilas. And before you know it, you're pregnant again.
Okay. So 18 years later, did he look kind of the same? I mean, a lot changes in 18 years.
He was so good looking when I knew him. That was the problem with this man. He was so outrageously, Forrest, he was so good looking. He was so outrageously good looking when I knew him. Women just took their clothes off in front of him, and he didn't say no. He did not say no. And he had a lifestyle in Hollywood that, you know, basically shamed Charlie Sheen. He made Charlie Sheen look like a choir boy during his life in Hollywood. So when I found him again, he was, he looked the same. He was still stunningly handsome. He physically is 28. It's outrageous. I met him again, but he had changed a bit. He was more settled, and he was a person now who could work consistently and maintained a fairly seemingly normal lifestyle. He wasn't he was no longer a roadie for Ozzy Osbourne. So he seemed to be living a more just a more normal lifestyle, and he looked the same. And the thing was, the electricity was immediate. It was just, I felt like I was in a way back time machine, that I had literally way back time machine myself back to when I was, before I was pregnant, when I was 23. Here I was presenting this man, this myself to this man again, almost like a bride would. And I really mean that. I had prepared to see him. I looked better than I ever had. I had really thought about it. I had cleaned my house. I had done my taxes. Everything was done. I just wanted to feel like I had hit some sort of a milestone when I met him. And it was the first time in my life since I was 22 that I had some freedom. Here I was, a 42-year-old woman with some cash in the bank and some time on my hands. I sounded like an Eagle song, and I just played it out over 3 weekends, you know, having a torrid affair. I really, really did, because I needed to know. This also is important. I needed to know I was a woman, because I'd lived through a marriage with celibacy. 100% celibacy, including my wedding night. I swear it's the truth. I told it to everyone. And so here I was, a woman with a child, left the nest now because he was 18. He was going off to college. My husband had moved away to move on with his career and expected me to follow him again in my celibate marriage now of 15 years. And I was a young woman suddenly with freedom like I hadn't known. I felt like I was 22 again, or who I wanted to be when I was 22, and who I wanted to be when I was grown up and done with school and ready to hit the world. Well, here I was, ready to do it again. And it was almost like I recapitulated right back again to where I was. And more people, it was not a happy pregnancy the second time. You would have thought the first pregnancy would have been really sad and under tragic circumstances, but it wasn't. And this one, the second one with my son, Ansel Jackson, was fraught with sadness. Here I was with the man I always wanted to be with, that I thought about for 18 years, and yet I was in the middle of a messy divorce and ending a life I had no intention really maybe of ending. I hadn't really thought, when I was having an affair and figuring out what's sex, you know, it was Paradise Bed, the dashboard life. It was a Meatloaf song and I couldn't get over it. And I just didn't think, oh, what's it going to be like when I unravel all of my life, my grown-up life? What's that going to be like? And so my pregnancy when I was 42 was a hidden secret pregnancy. It was totally secret. I hid in my house. I didn't let next door neighbors or close friends see me. No one knew it was happening but my closest friends, who maybe lived out of town. And the father by then had decided to come move to Arizona to be with me. He now was the one interested in having a child, and I was not. I was the one who couldn't, who said, I can't trust you. You've left other children. I can't trust you well enough to have a child. And I'm a big grown-up adult who knows what it's like to raise a child alone, and I didn't think I could do it. So there was a lot of disharmony.
So at this point, did your youngest son know that was his father? And
yes, Christopher. Yes, Christopher had to then reconnect while I was pregnant in front of him with a father he had never known. While he was disconnecting from me, it was turmoil in a house that should have been able to come together, but it was not. It was Christopher running away to college and me mad at him. He didn't understand what I was doing. He felt like I had cheated him out of the opportunity for him to move off to Hollywood and get to know his father alone. Instead, the father came here, and he felt like it was about his father and I, not about them. And he wanted it. He was going into this relationship thinking it was about them, and it was about the father and I. So he was mad at me for the first time in his life and deserted me. My son, Christopher, for the first time, we were inseparable. It was always just the two of us. Even when I was married, it felt like it was just Christopher and I, and we were married. We were pawns in a marriage, pretty much. We were there for insurance purposes and to look good. And so this was rough. This was really, really rough. So I decided when I was pregnant, I wasn't going to be able to keep this child. I don't know what I was thinking, but I totally said, I can't keep this child. There's just no way. There have to be people better than us to raise a child. We're not in a relationship. This is not a marriage. I'm still technically married to somebody else at this point. This is not a good situation for a child to be raised in. And me raising a child as a single mother a second time probably is not the right psychological situation for a child. So I went through the desperate search of finding the perfect people to adopt my child while I'm living here with the father who's willing to do this for me because I've already raised one of our kids, so he doesn't have a whole lot of cards to play in the whole game here. He better just be supportive. And he was, but he really, I could tell, wanted to keep the baby. But I did not know if that would be a good idea because he did not raise his first two children either or the child he had with me. So I began a search. I found a couple. I thought they were wonderful. They came and visited us. We met with them. We had lunch. I met their child. I conversed back and forth with them. We moved ahead with details. And then my gut told me something wasn't right. Something wasn't right about the situation. We're only maybe 3 weeks from delivery date. And something besides the baby inside of me is saying, something's not entirely right. And I'm not getting the answers I need from the adoption agency about the adoptive couple. And I am questioning things and I'm feeling things. And I'm a prayer. I'm praying to God, show me the way. I'm screaming in my backyard, help me, help me, help me. Show me what it is. And I find out maybe 2 weeks before, no, or 2 weeks before the baby's, you know, was scheduled to be born. Not that this is a problem, but maybe for me it is, that this family has had some problems. The father's been in federal prison for embezzling maybe $2 million from one of his clients. It was the secretary's fault. There was a big story. In any case, this, I did not want my child raised in a family where money was an ongoing issue because I've already heard these arguments in my past. I've heard this as my childhood. This is part of my verbal memory, and I think they're lying to me. They got a lot of skeletons in their closet. I'm sure they're nice people. I'm sure time served. Everybody's nice people, but I didn't feel good. So I immediately discontinued my relationship with them. And I consulted another adoption representative immediately who put me in touch with the most amazing family. Professors at a university, a couple, both professors, One's the head of a law department. The other's the head of another department. They're magical. They're perfect. They're perfect. Except they're on their way to Brazil to do a little research. So I tell them, okay, I can do this. I can do this by myself. I can birth this baby by myself. I can wait until you come back to Brazil, and then I'll give you the baby. I think I can do this because I think I'm really generous. I think I'm so generous and so wanting to do the right thing for my child, for his future, that I can live through whatever this pain is. I can live through this. This is okay. So the family is off in Brazil, and I'm preparing for the baby to be born, and my oldest son is living here in the house with me and his father. And I'm not a happy woman at all. I've gained a lot of weight. I've been in hiding now for months. I haven't told anyone I'm having a baby. I've also begged my best friend from high school to take the child. She's had no children of her own and is very loving, maternal, financially comfortable woman. I begged her. She said she could not do this, but would be there for me in any way. I begged my other best friends. They came from Chicago. They had no children. They'd always wanted to have a child. I begged them to take the child. She went to Europe and got pregnant. They could not take the child. Before I knew it, I was in the neighborhood hospital. I did not bother having birthing classes. There was no nursery prepared in the house. There was no diaper. There was no plan for a child to come home and be with me. I was literally psychologically thinking, I'm doing the right thing and I'll get through this. It's going to take some counseling. I'm going to get through this, but I'm going to have done the right thing for someone. So we go to the hospital. Mind you, I feel that I can have a baby by myself, so I don't go until 20 minutes before the baby's going to be born. And I don't want to, I'm very frugal because I'm paying for all of this on my own. I have no health insurance. So I wouldn't even go into a delivery room. I stayed at home and sat in my bedroom. And I remember I was watching this movie called The Other Boleyn Girl. It's about Henry VIII's mistresses and their various children, and a child is birthed in the movie, and I remember watching this thinking, this is the moment, this is the universe's moment, at least with me having a baby here. At least there's the feeling that I'm a bigger part of something, and there's something here for me, even if it's not a friend holding my hand and certainly isn't going to be a family member or anything like that. I'm okay. And we went to the hospital. We skipped all that walking, all that, you know, anything, ice chips, anything anybody else ever talked about in their birthing story wasn't a part of it. We just went into the room. I said, it's time to have the baby, because I was ready to be done now. And my son, I didn't know the sex of either of my children. I felt the surprise was just, you know, part of birth is the surprise. And since there was no plan for me to swaddle a child in blue clothes, I certainly wasn't planning what the sex was. It didn't matter to me one way or the other. I just wanted a real nice, beautiful, happy, healthy baby. It was an easy, 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 easy delivery. I remember even thinking ahead, I'm going to be getting up on my feet and squatting. Because I used to say to people, I literally could deliver in a field, pick up the child and move on and work. Because I was just such a worker, such a Midwestern girl. I'd ridden a bike when I was still pregnant with Christopher during my first pregnancy. I literally rode a bicycle to my last appointment at Georgetown because I had no transportation and no money. And the only way to get there was to ride a bike. So for me, the thought of having my second child and just having the baby and going home the next day and going back to work was exactly what I did. And I literally went back home with the baby the next day and thought, I'm waiting for somebody to come back from Brazil to get their child. And I came home And I started nursing the baby. And you know how, even if you don't think you're bonding with a child, you are bonding with a child. Even if you don't think you are still in these moments that might not, you might not be looking at your child and thinking, oh, they have their father's eyes, or they have a nose like their grandfather. Those weren't the thoughts. I think it's the unverbal moments. It's the back and forth symbiotic energy between you and your child. And here I am for the first time now with the father of my child in the home. And this is where it changes. I see the father now with this child in his arms, and he's more into the child than I am. I'm into my son, who at this point we haven't quite named. We haven't selected a name. I didn't feel like I should be doing that. But I see this baby with his father and the way he holds him. And I think, oh, this is what this older father now, this father now is 51 years old, who's never raised any of his kids. He has four other children he's never raised. Here he is in front of me, and I am seeing him for the first time in this loving parental role where he cannot get enough of taking care of the baby. It's all about him, and I think this is his child. I'm letting him bond with this child. Maybe I'm letting him bond with this child because I don't want him to leave. You know, I want him so connected. And I remember having these thoughts. I want him connected to this child so he won't leave the child. He needs to be with this child. And so for about the next week, although I was nursing the baby, I knew I was psychologically stepping back. And I was letting him take the lead role, whereas often it might be a mother who's all involved, or a doula, or some combination maybe of a mother, father, and somebody's mother coming. This was really more about him having this time. And I saw him for the first time in this really, really gentle, loving, compassionate way. And I start to realize this baby is not leaving us. This baby is not going anywhere. And now I'm in another whole realm of turmoil. I'm like in another realm of Dante's hell, where I'm, oh my God, I've just had this baby. I'm still married. I have this man living in my house that I'm not really in love with. I was in lust with for sure, but not necessarily in love. That's a whole other longer love in a big way, but love on a daily, day in and out, not sure about that. You know, because I'm just having an affair with somebody that I've had an affair with when I was in college. So I started to feel that things were changing, and the family came back. I had written them some beautiful emails, and we had to take the baby. I remember the adoption person came to us here, and we wrote down a name. I didn't choose the name. The baby's father chose his name, Ansel Jackson, which was sort of interesting because I remember he'd seen a number of Ansel Adams PBS documentaries. I think the name was in his mind, but it also connected to my work as an artist and doing large landscapes that were very inspired, maybe not me personally looking at Ansel Adams' work, but people looking at my work and seeing realism and black and white vintage photography in my paintings, my drawings. There was a visual connection. So he chose the name, and he went along with the idea that we were going to still adopt this baby. But somewhere in my mind, I thought, I don't know if we're really, really doing this. But we did get in the car, and we did go to the family's home. And we left that baby for a night. We drove back home without the baby. And the baby was about 2 hours away from me for a night. And I got up the next morning and I walked into my backyard and I screamed, what have I done? What have I done? What have I done? And so I called the woman, I called the new mother, and I begged for my child back. And I cried and I begged and I begged and I cried, and I didn't have a leg to stand on, and I begged and I cried like I could will this child back into my life or control the situation somehow. And they politely argued with me, very politely, very kind, very, very kind, and said, we don't have to do this. And I said, of course I know you don't have to. I know you don't have to do this for me. And they agreed to let me come and get my son. So we drive. My karma, I'm spending a lot of time now in my life, now in the last 7 years, trying to make everything okay with people. So I drive and I pick up this child and I pull this child from this woman's arms. She's weeping. I'm weeping. Everyone's crying. No one's happy. No one's happy. I'm happy, but I'm not happy. There's nothing happy about it. And we take the baby home and I'm not happy. The baby's with us, but I'm not happy. And I know I have broken hearts. I have broken a family. I look at a grandmother there visiting and she tells me, you've broken hearts. And I know I've broken hearts. I know everyone hates me. I'm in turmoil and pain. And I remember driving to the Walmart and thinking, what am I doing? What am I doing? What am I doing? Now I have a baby living with me in my adult life. My very, very manicured, perfect adult life. There's nowhere in my house have I thought about a child coming or what's going to happen. But I'm in a situation light years different than I was 20 years before when I had my first child. And yet I wasn't prepared at all. But I was told, I knew you don't need color schemes in a bedroom and a mural painted. None of that is necessary. You need some diapers. And so I went to Walmart and got diapers and thought, I can't believe this is happening. We're moving forward with this, but this is what we're doing. And it really became a one day at a time. Really, really, really slowly, because I'd never felt like a woman who had embraced being pregnant. I'd never worn maternity clothes. There was no baby shower. There was no excitement of a family. There were no phone calls. There were no flowers. There was nothing that said, this is a cherished experience. Instead, it was this beautiful child that came to a broken home of parents that weren't together and siblings that didn't know each other. But the thing that became magical about this child is that Jack, Ansel Jackson has always been known as Jack, began the beginning of a family. There were remnants of his family everywhere when he was born. There was a 30-year-old brother in Los Angeles, and now his other brother, who at that time was 20, when he was born was 20, then moved off to Los Angeles. And all of these siblings started to meet each other. The two brothers in Los Angeles met for the first time and became very close, adore each other. And a family started to come together that had never been a family. Suddenly, Jack had two parents he was growing up with, and Christopher had two parents living in a house for the first time that knew each other, and he had the older brother that he had always prayed for but never knew that he had, that he's very, very close with as an adult, and he had the younger brother that he always wanted. And this family that had no connection throughout its seeming life suddenly now is coalescing around this baby like he's the fire. He's the fire that holds us all together, and we all couldn't get close enough to him. And so I would say that my pregnancy now in retrospect now seems kind of happy and joyful. It had moments that of excitement. I remember that no one knew I had a baby, and I hadn't told anybody I'd had a baby, and I whittled myself back down to my pre-baby weight like in a blink of an eye, like Hollywood stars try to do to be on People magazine, because I wanted to be that girl that I still now wanted to get back to who I thought I was. I was always trying to get back to who I thought I was and missed out on. So I just, I was really back to who I was. You could never tell I'd had a baby. So about, I remember it was 6 months after Jack was born, I had a show at a gallery. No one knew I'd had this child. I'd already committed to have this show in a gallery, and I worked every single day. Take that, Marissa Yahoo takes off for 2 weeks. I didn't take off 2 hours. I came home the next day and started working again. Literally started working, painting, painting, painting. The gallery owner convinces me to show up with the baby at the gallery opening and do it all in one night. Because the gossip, she said, why piddle it out for 4 months? Do it one night and let everybody talk about you for 2 weeks and it'll be over and they'll be on to the next person. So I summoned up my courage, took my baby to my gallery opening and held him the whole night while people said, when did you have a baby? How could you have a baby? And of course, people, I could see them doing like sort of weird math in their head. I could see it. I could tell. And I just sort of thought, let them figure it out. I've just lived through the weirdest, most bizarre public celibate marriage. I have been through a bizarre trajectory with more strange men in my life and disassociation with people. If I can't live in the shame of what I've done and the blessing of my two children, well, you know, everybody's got things. So here it is. This is what I've done. And people talked about it for about 2 weeks. It was very juicy and exciting, and if they really knew all the details, it would have been at least a 2 month story, but...
So was your man at the opening?
Yes.
So you introduced your 6 month baby and the new man in your life to these people who had known you as this power couple.
Yes, absolutely. They were stunned. They were stunned. Stunned, stunned. Of course, I was at that moment. I was pretty much, you know, persona non grata from you know the A crowd of museum events. But that's okay. You know, life is a little more important than Chardonnay than the Chardonnay tour. So, it became a whole different life then. It became like being in some ways a parent for the first time. You have all the knowledge, but in some ways, you're still the first-time parent because you're doing it 20 years separate, and everything is different. Everything is different. The return back to your body isn't the same. I'd return back to who I was, but that was a force of will. That was because I had so many issues in my head about who I was as a woman physically, and I was really wanting to look like a girl that didn't have a baby. I wanted to look like a woman who had not had a baby. I wanted to be a size 6 again as fast as I could.
It's body image has been one of those topics that we've really been excited for women to talk about. Because mm-hmm. they don't. I mean, mm-hmm. we've had women that said, I didn't want to get fat when I was pregnant. Like,
I let myself get fat both times. I was totally like, this is it. I have lots of weight issues. I'm a yo-yo. I go up and I go down. I control myself with my weight. I can lose a lot of weight and be way for thin. I lost so much weight before I got pregnant to get my husband's attention. I carved off every ounce I physically could so I would hope he would see that something was wrong with me. I wanted him to look at me. I remember screaming at him, look at me, I'm disappearing physically in front of you to get your attention. Aren't you getting it? You don't see how thin I am? You don't see
that I'm down to like 107 pounds. That's pretty thin on me. That is really thin on me. You know, I'm avoiding, I can, willpower, I can kick myself into don't eat, don't eat, don't eat, don't eat to get your attention, which is a pretty weird thing to be doing already still in your 40s, but trying to get my husband's attention, who wanted nothing physically to do with me as a woman. I thought it was probably because I was too fat, I wasn't attractive enough, I wasn't sexy enough. So I was trying to get this puritanical, stuffy guy's attention, so I took off all the weight I could. It was the last thing I could find wrong with me. My house was clean, I had money in the bank, my career was pretty good, my child was raised. I'd given everything away that was clutter in my house. How about the clutter on my body? I'll give that away too. So I just kept, I eliminated it so that I could figure out it wasn't me he wasn't having sex with. It was, he wasn't having sex. It wasn't, I had to be able to get to, it wasn't me. And so once I figured out I'd lost all this weight, he's not having sex with me. Well, I know who will have sex with me. The father of my child, the one man, the last man I had sex with 18 years ago, who has had sex with everyone, will not turn me down. I mean, that was kind of desperate when you think about it. And yet, I loved him, and there was so much sexual chemistry. I did not, I felt at that time that I did not have time to have an appropriate affair with a nice man to get divorced and meet a nice man. I didn't have time for that. And I wasn't, because I was 42 and I wanted to have a child. I had no biological clock ticking sort of thoughts going through my mind. I was thinking, I am finally free. Finally free as an adult, because I was the only person taking care of my child. Even when I was married, it wasn't a family where the father was taking care of his stepchild. It was still my child. I just didn't have time to meet a nice guy. I just wanted to be who I thought I should have been at another time in my life. And here was this man that I'd had so much sexual chemistry with, who seemed to be able literally to have any woman he wanted. He could have any woman he wanted, and I just wanted to be wanted by any man. I mean, how weird is that? I wanted to be wanted by any man. He could have any woman.
And he wanted you.
And I, yeah, and really, that would have been great if he wanted me, and he was more than happy to see me again. I was the best version of myself that I'd ever been. I mean, who doesn't want that for a time in your life, where you actually think about the best version of yourself and feel that you're hitting that time in your life? Maybe it is your prime. Maybe I was. I've said to people, I was probably so outrageously fertile by then. I was so fertile and just dying to have sex. I was so dying to have sex. I remember feeling it was like girls who think about their wedding night. It really felt more like my wedding night, the night I had an affair, than the night of my wedding night. My wedding night, I remember we did not have a hotel room. We were just going to come back to be in the house that we own. Why would we rent a hotel room to have sex in? We weren't going to be having sex. So there would be no room, there would be no romance. None of that would be happening. And some of my close friends felt that seemed a little unusual and decided to get a hotel room as a gift for us to set the stage. That helped. I also remember on my wedding night, running alone in my wedding dress, barefoot through the dewy grass, so I could find some matches, so I could light that joint, because I knew I was alone that night, alone in my wedding dress. I knew I would be. There was my groom asleep. No big surprise. Someone had brought me a joint, and there I was, alone with my thoughts and my memories. And I sat there alone, thinking, as soon as I take off this dress, the magic will be over. And, you know, it was. There was just no planning in my marriage that, you know. I remember my husband said to me, "Well, you knew when we got married we weren't having sex." And I thought, Well, I kind of thought in the comforts. I mean, I hate to seem so Pollyanna, but I thought in your uptightness way, maybe in the bonds of marriage, you would feel more comfortable and it would be okay. And we would work to this, having sex and being a patient, really patient, considerate woman. I would be able to help you work beyond maybe even the most basic, you know, missionary. Maybe we could just get to a missionary position, but that never happened. So by the time I'm 42, I haven't had sex in like 18 years. I'm more than curious. I'm just wanting to have sex. So I plan to have an affair. Fair, which is a strange thing to do when you're a married woman, but it was deeper. I knew it wasn't physical. Even when I was planning to have an affair, it wasn't about physically having an affair so you could have sex. I wanted to know something about myself as a woman. Was I a sexually desirable woman? Was I desirable to somebody else? What was wrong with me? All of these problems I'd had as a young woman trying to figure out my own sexuality. I was promiscuous as all get out as a Catholic high school girl in the back of a car. I was entirely promiscuous. And so I was really looking for, I was probably acting this out again as an adult. I was just repeating these same patterns because the questions hadn't been answered. I hadn't gone through these natural transitions a person should as they move along their sexual evolution. I hadn't answered these questions. They'd always seem to be snuffed out. Like I would get close to the answer of finding out something about myself, and then the door was closed and I'd go on with life and I would have to just deal with things. But the questions would still be there. So I think by the time I'd had an affair, it was, I'm not emotionally married to this man. I'm not sexually married to this man. I'm certainly not spiritually married to this man. I'm married to this man for him, for social reasons, which I always knew was the point, even when I got married, because I'd read this book in art school about the evolution of a woman's personal life. And the writer's name, the sociologist, I'm so embarrassed I'm going to forget her name. Is it not Margaret Bourke White? She was a photographer. She wrote about these five different stages in a woman's life and how you might, or it was about marriage and evolution. You might get married when you're young for certain reasons. You might get married for love and lust and because you married somebody that when you were 22 because you met in high school or college and you got married. But if you got married probably maybe a little later in your life, you might get married for career reasons. My marriage was for career reasons. My husband married me entirely because it looked good. Looked good on his career. I looked good for his career. I paid all the bills. We lived on my income. And so who could go wrong? I made lunch and coffee and ironed and made the bed. What was wrong with this situation? Except that my heart wasn't being filled. And I thought, I think that if I would have married now later in my life, now that I'm 50 and I'm not married, but I've been now with the father of our two children for 7 years, I would marry for companionship. Because you marry later in your life, maybe it's your second marriage, maybe it's your third, maybe you're gay now and you're a lesbian and you're marrying the person you really want to be with. You choose people. I swear, you choose somebody not who makes your bottom line look good. You think, yeah, who will hold my hair when I'm vomiting in a toilet after chemotherapy? Who'll go and get me Depends diapers when I'm incontinent but still knows how much I care about how good I look when I go out? Who'll be the person who I could tell my deepest, really dirty secrets to and still feel okay about? And in the end, for me, it's been this one consistent man that I met when I was 22.
He's the lust guy. He's the love guy.
He is. He's the companion man. He actually is the man who answers all of those reasons that you would choose to maybe get married. I would have probably married him each time now in my life. And I've never seemed to have chosen him, but he's always been there. And in some ways, the circumstances, I have always managed to bring him he's the one who says to me, "You're right where you're supposed to be." When I'm complaining and arguing, "No, you're right where you're supposed to be. Timing is perfect. Timing is divine." It's taken us many years to get to this.
My husband feeling. Is an older father. And, he was 50, I think, when August was born, or something like that.
You get it, that older.
And but he's never been married, never had a kid, and he said, "I was never ready to have a be a father until today, until now. It took being 50."
Jack's
for me to
father,
be a father
took him till he was 50 to be a father, a dedicated father.
Yeah.
To the point that Jack is 7 and in second grade, and he still shares a bed with his father.
Oh, yeah.
They still sleep together, and we sleep in separate rooms. Sleep's important. I love my sleep.
Love.
It has nothing to do with sex.
It has nothing to do with sleep.
No, sleep and sex and bedrooms are different things. People should sleep in adjoining bedrooms and have sleep. Absolutely. You got all kinds of rooms to have sex. You can have sex all kinds of much better places than the bed you sleep in. I don't get it. I don't understand that. But
no, yeah, and it's true.
Older fathers can commit.
If he had had a baby previously, he said, I would have failed as a father. I've been in circumstances where women wanted to get married and make babies with me in my 30s, and I knew I wasn't going to be able to.
Jack's father had 2 children when he was in his late 20s, and I knew who those children were, and he had no one. Tension, I think, of so much being married and having children, but he had 2 children born, and he married the mother of his 2 kids, and it really didn't suit who he was as a person in any way at all, and he just fled. And he's a very, very, very lucky man. He's a lucky man that I knew when I was raising Christopher, I was really careful. Someone had told me, or maybe I heard it on Oprah, don't say mean things about a parent that's not there. Do not do it. Because it's not about the parent that's not there. It's what you're imprinting on the child. It's what you're saying to the child about part of them, or the parent that's not there is somebody they connect to. So don't start creating a negative narrative that's going to infect, and I mean infect, that child for the rest of their life. So we didn't talk about a missing father. There was never a mean word said. We didn't talk about him not being there. There were a lot of really nice male role models that were college friends of mine that would come around, and a friend who came and read to Christopher when he was growing up. But we never said a word about his missing father or even refer to it. So when he, as an adult, met him, he didn't come with like a whole train load of luggage. You know, his baggage wasn't years of my attitude. It just wasn't
the
there.
The father must have really appreciated it.
Well, I hope he did. I pointed it out a few times. Like, the reason you have such a free-flowing, amazing relationship with your son is because I never said. If I did one, I did a lot of bad things. I pulled a child away from a mother. I've done a lot of bad things. But one of the good things in my pro column is I really knew. I knew during the 18 years of raising my son, even during the poverty and the bad days and not having food and being really super poor, and I didn't have a car for 3 years, I did not say bad things. I didn't blame someone who wasn't there, never a word. So this adult could have a really great adult relationship. They didn't have to work through years of what was not really even there.
You know, I really feel for that family, but I can't help but think
what I've gone through.
Don't fucking go to Brazil.
Well, you know, I chose a family that had big projects in their future. They were very creative, interesting projects,
right?
And I spent some time with a variety of therapists after all of this in my life, you know, because a lot of friends of mine said to me, "I think you should give that baby away and just sort of try to hold the pendulum steady here, Ellen, because you are making some radical swings, you know, you are going back and forth." And what I realized was I did this very hurtful thing, and I was going to have to do a lot of soul searching and do a lot of things to try and make things better in my family's life, And hopefully, a ripple effect would eventually quell what I had done to this family 2 hours away from me, what they had been through. And I've thought about them, and I have been in the community where they have lived and done things there and thought, I wonder if they remember my name. And I remember them. This mother was so good. She looked at her daughter, her five-year-old at the time, and said, well, let's just think of it as we took care of the baby for a night, and that he was our baby for a night, and that was good enough for us. And I thought, man, that's a good mother. If I could even be maybe 10% of what this mother was going to be, I'd be a pretty good mom to my child. Because this one, I could tell she was going to have to explain this to her daughter a couple of different times, and she would cry over this. And maybe, if this were the best thing, maybe part of what I was doing in her life was I was placed in her path. If this were a good, if you could like make it look good for yourself, to make myself better, feel a little better, maybe I was placed in her life's path. Because she wanted to have another baby, she told me, and she had tried to, and it wasn't happening, and she had a very high power career. Maybe she wasn't meant to have a baby. Maybe I was pushed through in her life, in my painful way, to help her to understand. Maybe you weren't going to have a baby because you had the child you were anticipated to have. Maybe she had a child after. I have no idea. I chose not to keep in touch because I did not want to drag. I thought about keeping in touch with them, and there was an offer, but I thought, I can't put these people through more pain. I can't go back to them in a year if I'm still in pain over this and offer. I can't do it. So I disconnected entirely and didn't keep in touch because I thought, dragging people through my soap opera just is not going to happen. So I...
Some women you talk to, I felt, are very connected with the universe, but with you, it's like shocking.
It's big. Well, then I found out, it seems like this was about a year ago. About a year ago, I met this woman, friend of a friend. It was a new friend in my life. A new friend comes into my life that has no connection to my marriage or my past, and that's exactly what I needed. Somebody didn't know anything about me and didn't care. So this new friend comes into my life, Bob, and it was so interesting. He was so much of my ex-husband, all the good things about my ex-husband that I wanted to hang out without having to hang, all the good without the bad aftertaste. So Bob introduces me to this really interesting woman, and her profession is, she's a medium. She says, I talk to dead people. And I did not want to meet her as a medium because I just wanted to sit back, and I didn't want to be aggressively excited about her mission. I was maybe a little skeptical. And so he introduces me, and I think I'm meeting this lovely woman, Mariah, as a friend, and my friend Bob, and how wonderful this is. And she's this really interesting woman. And we go out, and she's going to be a nice new friend to me. And we go out and have dinner, very casual. I'm not even into the first glass of wine being ordered. And she starts telling me things about stuff she could never know about my life. She just starts saying things across the table about me. And it's specific, I'm bringing it up because it has to do with my pregnancy. She says to me, I'm here. There's someone here that wants to speak with you. And she starts describing somebody. And I say to her, that's my grandma Olga. I know it's my grandma Olga. She gives me details that no one could know about these three gold rim plates, that one that I'd taken off of my grandma's wall that I use as my drawing palettes. And they have the Kennedys on them, and the plate broke, and how sad this was to me because it felt so sad about my grandma and how I keep trying to rebuy the plate. And she says to me, to prove to me that this is my grandma here speaking to me, don't worry about the gold plates you keep breaking. Clearly a detail no one would know because it's only about my grandma and I. So she goes on to tell me in the course of a 5-hour dinner that the reason The reason that I was not able to have an abortion with my first child, Christopher, the first or second appointment, which I have always wondered what could have happened. The two doctors don't show up. I mean, what are the coincidences in this? She says to me, your grandma passed just before you were pregnant. And she, I swear this is true, exchanged a lot of life force energy and cannot explain to you in words what she went through to make happen this child to save your life. And I'm sitting here looking at this woman who's telling me these crazy details. Again, nothing that could be Googled. I've never met her. She doesn't know me. But she tells me all of the previous details about when I was pregnant back in Washington, D.C. in 1987, and the why of this and the why of that. And she knows this because she feels this presence is telling her all these things I need to know about my life. What my sadness with my mother was, the bad relationship with my father, the running away from being with my family, why I always feel so bad about myself. She explains all of these things via of this energy that she feels that is standing with her as my grandma and explaining my life to me. It was the most cathartic experience. Then this summer, now in this relationship, this conversation I have with Mariah over a year, which happens about every 3 months, usually with the presence of my grandma telling me more details, including going back into my grandmother's home on the farm in Iowa, the only place the woman ever lived. It was amazing. Nothing had changed in the house. The wallpaper from 1932 was still on the walls. It was insane. I felt the presence of the woman. The people who owned the farm were the neighbors who knew my grandmother and said, people feel the presence when you walk in the house. We just want you to know. And I said, I know, that's what I've come for. I've come to feel my grandmother and have this. This just happened in April, this past April. I feel like I've had this full circle event. And it is really because, in some ways, that I had to answer these questions of my children, who I am, where I've come from. I feel this connection to this farm in Iowa, which previous to living in Arizona, all of my work was about landscape and the family and the farm and where I've come from and who I am, even though I'm totally disconnected to my immediate family. I have no connection whatsoever. I feel this intense connection to my grandmother on my father's side, and because of the farm and the family and the multitude of generations that have all lived in this one farmhouse. It was a log cabin at one time. So I went back just in April to feel the full circle thing of it. And at that time I realized, as I was standing there, this is where my father, who I have had the worst relationship with all of my life, I was never a child who sat on her father's knee, I was never loved by my father, I never felt that daddy's, I did not have my father walk me down the aisle at my wedding, none of those experiences happened for me. But while I'm in that house, you know, I'm feeling the years and the smells and just the years of lives that have been in this house. And my father, I convinced myself then I can forgive him for everything that has happened and release from this. So in June, I write this long, well, no, it wasn't even long. It was just, it was very short. It was a long thought to get to it. It was a very short letter that said, I forgive you. Because I feel that my grandmother has told me, your father will die soon, and for you and your soul, you need to forgive this man and for your children, and so that you can always feel that you did the right thing. You need to get over, because you've gotten over it. You need to tell him you got over it. So I wrote him this letter and said, I'm over the sadness, I'm over the hurt, I'm over this weird relationship I had with you and your best friend and the bizarre sort of name-calling that scarred me for life. I told him in the letter, every relationship I had with every single man was tainted by my childhood relationship with you and the name-calling. It wasn't a sexual abuse relationship. It doesn't, and that's the saddest part. Everybody was sure I was sexually abused. Everyone I knew, oh, it must be because you were sexually abused. It wasn't. To me, it was worse.
Oh, mental abuse.
It went worse than sexual abuse. To me, have sex, I could be done with that and forget about that. If I had to, I could compartmentalize that to a bad experience. It was the everyday psychological eroding of my ego down to nothingness, to the point that I would marry a man full willingly, knowing I would never be having a full relationship with him because I'm not worth it anyway. I'm not worth having that, and I've been told this all my life. So it takes me my whole life and working it out through having just really dramatic, over-dramatic sexualized relationships with people, like my high school boyfriends, whoever it was. It was really, really intense. And I always knew it went right back to feeling like my father did not protect me. When I was 4 or 5 years old and this started, the name calling, he let it go on. And I knew it was wrong as a child, and my mother let it go on, and all the adults around me let it go on, and I knew it was wrong. And if I said something back, I was punished for it. You know, I couldn't say mean things back to the mean man who called me double ugly. I couldn't say any of these things. I was always being punished. I was this bad little girl trying really hard to be a good girl. I lived multiple personalities as a child, and I knew I was developing multiple Ellens. There was Ellen, the high school standout, who had to be the president of everything, the president of the student council, and the best at everything, and the best grades. I created this persona of who I was for my parents, and so I wouldn't get in trouble, and other adults and people would like me. But deep down, I was this whole other person inside who was sad and lonely, and always desperately trying to overcompensate, overachieve. Desperately a young woman trying to overachieve because I was so eroded as a person. You know, I just had no self-esteem as a young woman. I had none. And yet I created this persona that I had a lot of self-esteem and, you know, could get up and speak in front of thousands of people in 4-H, and I could get up and perform in musical performances and theater and band, and it looked like one person was going on, and deep down, I'd had my first abortion when I was a junior in high school, alone by myself, having sex because I couldn't tell my parents my high school boyfriend was raping me. I couldn't tell my parents this thing, and this is why. I remember my mother said to me, when my mother found out I was having sex in high school, she said to me, "What if your father found out?" And I looked at her and said, "Well, he certainly didn't tell so-and-so to quit calling me double ugly as a child. Why would he stop so-and-so from raping me as a high school girl and having sex with me?" And I couldn't get away from him. I couldn't get away from him. He was an older boy. I'd never had a boyfriend. I couldn't break up with him. He threatened me all the time. He threatened me verbally, physically, a lot of stuff. And I didn't have someone to say it to because my mother is just going to punish me. I'm going to get grounded for more stuff. I'm going to get locked in a room. I'm going to lock myself in a room. I can't get away from any of this. So I'm one person in front of people, and I'm another person in my secret life, my secret high school life that's going on. And I'm living these two dual lives. So the fact that these two dual lives becomes my modus operandum as I move through life isn't really very surprising when you really think about it. I get to college and I'm living as a college student by day, and I'm working as a cocktail waitress by night, or I'm living as a college student by day, and I'm an artist model at night, you know, and I'm pregnant, or I'm, again, as an adult, I'm living one dual life as a well-known, you know, power art couple, But I'm living an entirely different life. I used to tell people, when we would come home when I was married, when we would come home from big parties, looking like celebrities, you know, we were like the Brangelina. When we would come home, we would walk in from the garage and I would just start taking the facade off. It was like, take the clothes off. We don't have to fake to being the fabulous power couple anymore because we're not. And my husband would go to the bathroom and shut the door and lock it. And that would be it. That would, the night would be over. And I never once saw him without his clothes on. Never once. Isn't that amazing? Sometimes I'd go to the bathroom door on fun nights when you'd had too much Chardonnay and I would rattle the door and kid him while I was brushing his teeth. I'd rattle the door and say, I'm coming in, I'm going to see you.
So at this point, I mean, you must have come to the conclusion that that all of that was on him. Psychologically.
Like, well, I kind of started to realize right at the end, this is not all me. This cannot possibly be all me. There's just no way. Because I'm kind of a flirty girl. And I don't have problems thinking I can speak with you and enjoy flirtation by bringing out the best. Maybe you're standing with an older gentleman and you let him flirt with you when it's not sexual flirting. It's just social and fun. That's just bringing out your personality. I enjoyed that. And I knew that gentlemen responded to me because I was a fun, flirty girl standing there chatting it up with him. But I also knew, wow, my husband just doesn't see past this. But it took me a long time to realize, this is when I realized, it's all on you. When, after my son was born, Jack, my second son was born, and I was in the midst of the nastiest, by now messiest, divorce, because I'm starting to figure things out. I'm starting to, like, revelations are hitting me right and left, and I'm starting to go, I think you're a big cheater. I think my being celibate and holding on and being honest with you was allowing you just to live out whatever you wanted to do. And I don't know what he did when he traveled, but I do remember having a conversation with a woman who was a girlfriend of mine when I first moved here, and I felt a vibe with her about him, and I questioned her. And I questioned her and said, so did you have some sort of weird coitus with my husband? And she said, and this helped me feel better, you know, Ellen, I did have sex with him, but it was so weird. I'm not sure if it was actually sex or not. And I said to her, I know exactly what you're saying, because he's not a man comfortable with having sex, because he is a man who never figured out how to be comfortable with himself and his size. And size doesn't matter. Hey, you can do all kinds of stuff, but this man, size mattered. And he just was desperate. This is the weirdest thing. He was desperate to have sex with a certain kind of woman that he thought was really sexually appealing, because this other woman looked a lot like me. She had a similar kind of thing going on, and I thought she was quite attractive when I first met her, and even said to him, why aren't you dating her? I had clearly already felt the vibe the first night I met the woman that he had tried to have sex with her in some weird sort of way, because I think he was always trying to find the perfect girl to have sex with, and I was the perfect girl just to have a marriage with, because it looked pretty good to his mother and society and his social group and my bank account, and all of the things looked desirable to him except me, which was so sad, because I was working really hard to be, I was trying to overcome still this high school thing of being a really desirable girl. I was still doing it in my late 30s by then. I'm still desperately searching for it.
But in the end, I mean, you do realize it had nothing to do with your looks.
I had to have an affair to figure that out.
Okay.
I totally had to. I had to have an affair to figure out a man who could have sex with any woman if he would. I know that's totally twisted.
No, it's not.
I believed if he'd I just, it worked for me. For some reason, the fact that he, that there was the sexual, and we had a lot of sexual chemistry, and he was just really, it was the experience I was looking for. And so I went back and kept having this affair over and over and over. You know, it wasn't just then, clearly. I did not just have to have the act of having sex at a great resort and having a couple of drinks. It wasn't that. It was, I didn't even have sex the first night I was with him at this resort. It was more about the intimacy. It was intimacy. The clear word is intimacy. I didn't have intimacy with my husband at all. We only talked about what we would do in 5 to 7 years regarding our career track. His career track, I mean. Not mine. That didn't matter. I was a support network. His career track. We never talked about goals or what your spirit life was or what your faith, where your faith life might take you. Clearly, we couldn't sit and talk to each other about sex.
You've experienced truly like two out of the three most important men in your life were totally psychologically abusive to you.
Totally.
Yeah.
I didn't even get it.
Yeah. Different ways, but totally did it. Psychologically.
And I believed, I absolutely believed in my heart that I had attracted my husband because he was so different from my father. He was an academic. He was brilliant. He was smart. He was the kind of guy that society looked at and said, winner. My father was a card dealer who was a wisecracker,
but they still
who played poker.
To make
right.
You feel bad about yourself.
Oh, they still, and they yeah. both dismissed me in every way.
Yeah.
Possible.
Yeah. Isn't that amazing?
And yet I really believed. I totally believed. I drew my husband to him and me, and I was going to marry my husband because he was so different. I would not have the marriage my mother had.
He would never hurt you like your father.
No, he would be a good man and I wouldn't bicker with him and we'd have this nice life.
He just had to not fuck you.
He just didn't fuck me.
Yeah, that will fuck you up more in the head than...
I said to people, we slept in this little bed, this little antique bed that I had that I picked out of my grandmother's house. And I said to people, you know how sometimes when you're in college, you spoon or you sleep like a double helix mm-hmm. and you're all wrapped around each other. It's very intimate when you sleep together. It's like a sexual experience. My husband and I slept next to each other like knives. Don't touch each other. Sleep straight like this. Don't touch. And we both got excited when the other one would travel so we could bisect the bed and you mm-hmm. could sleep how you wanted to. But we never touched each other.
Yeah.
Never touched. And when he ran away with his assistant, a much younger, plausible, she looked like me. She could have almost been me. I mean,
Your affair didn't break up the marriage?
This is what broke up the marriage. He left. He left and thought I would follow along behind him. The plan was he left and I was going to pack up the house and move again and start my career somewhere else. Even though every time, like when I moved here, he told me, you can't tell anybody you're an artist. That'll affect my career. You can't show your work in this town. That'll affect my career. Like I was a co-core or something. I couldn't talk about myself. I was only supposed to just be there and say nice things.
Awesome.
I went along with this for a long time. I really did.
Yeah.
I totally did.
The universe putting you in connection with that, with your previous man and having that same sexual tension was really the what did it.
I think that's probably what did it. And he was gone by then. He'd been gone for about 4 months. He was living in another state, in another city, and I was intending to move. But something in my head said, if you move to that next city, where I really didn't want to move, it's like reaffirming the nonverbal contract that you have with your husband. It's like saying, I'm all good with this. I'll start again. I'll pack up everything. I'll move along with this celibate relationship. We'll do it your way.
Yeah.
And part of me said, I don't think so.
We are separating these stories into themes. And one of the themes is connection.
Uh-huh.
And I think yours is perfect.
It comes back to connectedness.
You know, you've said it so many times, and this, I really do imagine this, like when you mentioned the Big Bang too, but I also, it is this image of planets separating and then coming back together.
It's like we now this family. Well, I think it was we've had several Christmases, and I was never one of those persons that I'd never have a Christmas tree or celebrate a holiday. Just not me. But I found that now I kind of have this family that expects these kind of things, and I've taken Danny's oldest son. as if he's mine. And he sees me that. I swear he sees me as, oh, that's my father's non-wife, but, you know, or like she's my mother. I feel like he is also my son, you know, and it's become this really, really nice family. And the family that I had with my ex-husband, because I hated my family, I did not like my family. My nuclear little family was a facade. It was, we look like this on the outside. I learned how to do this when I was a child. Look like this on the outside. Something else is going on in the inside of your house. And it was. It was the most disconnected family. And my mother worked really hard to make it look like we were really something. And we weren't. And so when I disconnected, it was not good. It did not. There was a lot of yelling and screaming. And I think they are still waiting. It's been years. And I'm like, no, no, no. Just because we had years of hating each other doesn't mean we need years of hating each other. We really, 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 really don't. We can all move on and have different families and still be happy about it. And you can love your family there, and I can love my family. And I told my father in my brief letter to him, I have a nice family. I just wrote, I have a nice family. And I said to him, things are forgiven. All is forgiven.
So did he respond?
Well, I wrote also in the letter, you do not need to respond.
Sure.
I don't anticipate a letter back and don't want you to. I didn't think I'd get a letter back. And I also believe he did not get the letter. I emailed the letter to my high school art teacher, who offered to go and read the letter, because I knew if I mailed the letter to my family's home address, my mother would get the letter, read the letter, and dispose of it immediately. And it would never happen. So I sent someone over who had a friendship and would sit and read the letter. But my father's health had been deteriorating, which was what I felt was happening. Man never did not smoke a pack of cigarettes a day. So, you know, I felt it was time to write something for myself. And I realized, I don't know if he even heard the letter. The letter ended up being mailed to their home, and I'm guessing my mother picked up the letter and
maybe
probably.
Just putting pen to paper was enough.
It was enough for me. I felt fine.
Yeah.
She won't be getting one that says, I'm sorry for all the sadness. I'm sorry for everything that ever happened. My mother and I had the worst.
Giving birth to someone doesn't give you the right to.
No, no. I lived through nastiness, so I'm moved on from that. So
a family, the idea of a family is so much more than who gave birth to who.
It is. It is. Now, also in our family, my kid's father's grandmother, who lives in Miami, has come to stay with us a couple times. I had her come for 6 months. I'd never met the woman once, and she lived with me. And I'm like, this is great. There are cousins down the street. What I meant to say about family was I had disconnected from my nuclear family. And when I got married, I was desperate to be in a good family. Do you know what I mean? Like a really good family. Even in high school, I was always sort of adopting myself into my best friends' families, who had nice families where the kids would all go to college and they all supported each other. And they would kind of kid each other and rib each other, but they were all there for each other. I wanted to be in that kind of family. So when I got married, my husband had a very small family. It was just his mother and his sister. His father had already passed away. And so I absorbed myself into that family. And when I was divorced, they never said a word to me ever again. No one ever called me once. It was like I never existed. The girl who went on every family vacation, you know, and lit every campfire for the family at the cabin and organized the salt box regatta, you know, and all of these different things, they acted like I never existed. No one ever said my name again. And I was write her name, never say her name again. It's done. Never. And my ex-husband and I have never said another word again to each other. And why would we? Why would we?
Wow. I think we're good.